Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Kate Andrews, The Spectator's economics correspondent, and Policy Exchange's David Goodhart. So, what will the UK's post-Brexit immigration system look like? It's a topic of hot debate right now. We're expecting a Migration Advisory Committee report in the coming weeks, where it will give us guidance on what that should mean in terms of who gets to work here and what requirements they must meet. And one of the big topics of discussion is how exactly an Australian-style points-based system will work, what the government seems to be leaning towards. Kate, you can kick us off. For those who have just heard the term Australian points-based system several times in political debates, elections over the past couple of years, what do they actually mean?
So a points-based system in immigration is, in a very basic way of explaining it, one in which certain characteristics are allotted a certain number of points. And if you can add up enough points to get past the country's threshold, then you may well be able to migrate there to work and to live. So if we look specifically to Australia, they dish out points for a whole host of things, ranging from your age, your skill set, your level of qualifications and education, what job you might be applying for. In Australia, they even consider things like whether or not your partner is a high-skilled or low-skilled worker or able to contribute to the workforce. You get certain points for your proficiency in language. And so in Australia, you know, they are more centralized. The government puts more weight on bringing in the jobs and the skill sets that the government thinks Australia is going to need in the future. But there are lots of points-based systems around the world. I think the UK actually has a points-based system, which is more employer-led at the moment, but certainly a points-based system for non-EU migrants. If you want to come to the UK from anywhere outside of the EU at the moment, you are also using essentially a points-based system. So arguably, we already have one. The question is, how might it change going into the future?
Yes, David, the thing that is changing here is clearly the government has been very clear that freedom of movement is going to end. So it's what rules are going to affect EU citizens in the future who want to come and live here and work here. Given that Kate's suggesting we already have, in some ways, a points-based system when it comes to other countries, is this going to be a fairly simple process, do you think? Or is it something that's actually going to be very complicated?
Well, obviously, we hope it's going to be relatively straightforward. I mean, I think what matters is that for skilled workers, who are particularly the people who we will be most interested in coming in, possibly quite large numbers after Brexit, perhaps particularly people from European Union countries who in the past would have just come here under free movement rules, you know, you want a simple system. You want something that's light touch and easy to manage. You do also, though, want, you know, what we voted for in the Brexit referendum was for control, and I think for a modest decline in numbers, nothing very extreme. I think this is one of the reasons why the government loves this phrase, the Australian points-based system. As Kate says, we already have a points-based system, and actually a better one than Australians, because at least through the work stream, it requires employers to actually want to employ the particular person. So we have, as it were, a kind of employer-based point system, and I hope that we will continue with that. But I think one of the reasons why that the phrase, the Australian points-based system, has sort of gone into the political lexicon is because, well, it plays very well in focus groups. People don't necessarily know exactly what it means. But what it implies is control. Plus, we're not going to have no immigration. Control plus sort of certain numbers coming. As we know, anxiety about immigration has declined since the Brexit referendum, partly because of the Brexit referendum. This is not because suddenly everybody has turned into sort of, you know, very, very pro-mass immigration people. I mean, I think probably the same proportion of people, about two-thirds of the population, think that immigration has been either too high or much too high in the last 20 years or so. I don't think that's changed, but people's level of salience of the issue has gone down. So there is some room for manoeuvre, I think, that the government has. But I think they should, yeah, I mean, the real argument is about low-skill immigration. I mean, that's where the politics really starts to get heavy.
Before we just get to that, and I think some of the things that have been discussed this week, just on what you were saying there, David, during the election, a lot of the broadcast interviews of politicians were about, will immigration go up or down? Now, in a points-based system, there's no reason to think that is intrinsically going to mean immigration goes down, does it?
Not intrinsically, no. I mean, it depends quotas and... But, I mean, I hope it does go down. I mean, I think that's partly what people voted for. They don't want no immigration, but, you know, we have had immigration at historically unprecedented levels for 20, 25 years, and people want it to slow down. So it's not just about control. I'd say it is also partly about numbers.
Kate, when we're looking at what the government's going to do here, there's a big push on skills, and it seems that that's the metric that the government want to test the system on. So rather than looking at that in terms of, I suppose, finance. So there's a lot of debate right now about whether the £30,000 salary cap threshold is going to go. There are hints that it is, and the government's going to move to a skills focus instead. Do you think that is what is coming down the track, and is that a good idea?
I think it's great that they're indicating that they will scrap the £30,000 threshold. If you want young people, talented people in all kinds of high-skilled sectors, including tech, to come to the UK to work, a lot of those people aren't going to be able to come in at £30,000 a year. It doesn't mean they won't come in as net contributors, but they might have to start slightly lower. As well, it is in line with Boris Johnson's rollback of Theresa May's policy of making graduates, foreign graduates, leave the UK very soon after they've graduated. He's giving them now a two-year buffer to get a job. And I think that policy is in line with, you know, helping them to secure a visa, get on the working ladder, and stay in the UK. So I think from all those perspectives, it makes a lot of sense. My concern is that by the government focusing on high-skilled workers, it is going to decide that it knows best about what the UK economy will need, not just this year, but down the line, and start making exceptions or start adding on points to certain skill sets that centrally it thinks are a good idea, but may actually not be what business needs at all. I mean, how many examples do we need of the government just not having its finger on the pulse when it comes to immigration policy in particular? And the number of scandals we've seen there, to think that on top of that, they're going to be able to know what the tech sector, the business sectors really need in 5 years' time better than business itself, is quite farcical. So there are aspects of the Australian system in particular that I think are relatively liberal that the UK could bring. I mean, Australia actually does have a pathway on its points-based system to move to Australia without a job in line. In the UK, that is very, very difficult to do without some kind of loophole or exception for a non-EU worker at the moment. So they could import some good stuff, but I'm worried they're going to import this attitude towards centralization that I don't think is good for the economy.
In my view, this is just crazy liberalism. This is precisely just what we have voted against in a general election and in a referendum. I mean, to have a more liberal system than we had before would be absolutely crazy. Australia, by the way, has double the per capita immigration rate as the UK. Do not want that kind of Australian system. And I am worried about the what is being now said about the 30,000 threshold being chucked. I mean, in other words, we will continue to have quite high levels of people coming in to do middle and even low-skilled jobs. I mean, we have 4 million people in this country who are underemployed. We have 900,000 young people who are not, you know, NEETs, neither in employment, education or training. We have higher youth unemployment than Germany does. The truth is, employers have had a free lunch on immigration for the last 25 years or so. You know, and we've seen a collapse in the level of training that British employers do. We also don't want to do stupid economic things. We need quotas in some of these low-skill areas. I mean, food manufacturing, for example, a lot of sectors have become very, very dependent on foreign labour of various kinds. And we do not want to crucify these industries, obviously. We have to be careful, but it's a balancing act. So you give quotas, you give, even for lower skill workers, there may be a necessity for quotas, as in agriculture and horticulture. But you're also trying to encourage the employers to behave better. So, you know, if you constantly give them these, you know, free quotas for low skill workers from abroad, they will take them. So you've got to try and, you know, get a better balance there.
Kate, on that, if you're looking at, I suppose, how the government should approach various sectors, we've been told there'll be no opt-outs and so forth when it comes to fitting in the system. But there have been early signs that perhaps the government are taking an approach David would be happy with, in the sense that May have promised a temporary extension of the current rules until 2023. However, this government has said they're not planning to do that. And this was, again, this friction between big businesses who want what they would call low-skilled migrants and then the other side saying, actually, you should be employing from this country. So How do we work out when someone is low skilled, perhaps is a crass way of putting it, and someone doesn't earn more than 30k but is high skilled?
Well, I suppose a lot of that would come down to the sector, which is why I think that a lot of this should still be employment-led and employer-led, because that's a very important question you pose, Katie. How can the government just decide that somebody's salary totally represents their skill set? It doesn't. I mean, you have lots of college graduates who don't necessarily want right away to go into a sector that's going to make them loads of money because they have other priorities. If you decide to go into journalism, if you decide to go into the charity sector, you may be high-skilled, but you're salary may not be all that high. It doesn't mean that the work you're doing is unimportant. I would flag up a few things. I think that the UK certainly voted to take control of its immigration. But if you voted for Boris Johnson and you had any knowledge of his previous record as mayor of London or his attitudes towards immigration, then I don't think you were voting to necessarily lower immigration. When we look at the public's attitude towards migrants, it really depends on who they are. They are very pro-students coming over to the UK to study and staying. They're very pro certain levels of high-skilled immigration. And so I don't think the number itself is what matters here so much. And we're talking about immigration in the context of a country that has record unemployment. It's 3.8%. David, you mentioned that there are thousands of young people who don't have employment yet, but we have excellent unemployment records compared to the rest of Europe right now. A lot of people who are in unstable employment, people who are on those 0 hours contracts that people often blame for bringing in cheap labor, majority of them are actually quite happy with their situations. And sorry, the last thing I would, that a lot of them are quite happy with their situations and aren't necessarily looking for that full-time work for many different reasons. And as well, it has always been illegal to pay migrants less the same job that a native might be doing. This is a very complex issue. And to simply say, especially looking at Boris Johnson's record, that people who voted for him are anti-migration altogether, I don't think adds up.
I didn't say people were anti-migration.
That they want the numbers to come down.
That they want the numbers to come down.
I think that's a stretch. I think saying they wanted to take control is absolutely correct.
But Katie, we have a low productivity, low wage economy. And one of the reasons we have that is because there has been this huge supply of relatively high quality foreign labour. I mean, this is the, you know, if you're in food manufacturing or wherever, you know, you get a pretty good worker from Slovenia or Slovakia for, of course, people aren't allowed to pay them less, but you get more bang for your buck, as it were, because you're comparing like with unlike, you know, you're comparing people towards the bottom end of our social system, as it were, with people from the kind of middle or even the higher end. In countries, people who come here for 2 or 3 years to improve their English and they're working in a fish finger factory or whatever. So you can see why employers want to employ them. But we have a national social contract with our own 900,000 NEETs. And I mean, I worry more about them than I do about the kids from Slovakia. And I think that is what politicians, British politicians, should. I do have one bee in my bonnet, which is that there's a kind of missed opportunity somewhere where something on that we two might agree on is that I think we should have special antisocial hours visas. I mean, because I think, you know, a lot of the jobs we're talking about will be night shift, will be weekend work. And I think that is where your average British person acknowledges that most British people who often have family responsibilities, after all, really don't want to do those jobs, you know, really have to be sort of bribed to do those antisocial hours jobs. And people would sort of see it as reasonably fair because they know that they don't want to do those jobs. That, you know, you bring people in on special antisocial hours visas for a limited period of time, 2 or 3 years or whatever. You know, and a lot of people from abroad are young and unattached, and they're here simply to earn money, you know, and have a bit of adventure, and they're happy to do that kind of thing. So it's a sort of win-win situation. I think there'd be much less resentment against people coming in on antisocial hours visas because a little bit like agriculture and horticulture, very, very few British people want to do those jobs unless they absolutely have to.
Now, just to bring this podcast to a close, I want to ask you both briefly. You clearly, I think, come from different approaches in terms of how the numbers should factor into a positive immigration system. But if we fast forward and think, once this new immigration system is up and running, what do you think would be the metric that we should judge its success by?
I would say whether or not migrants are contributing to the UK economy. If you are a net contributor, then it would strike me that, you know, you're not a burden on the taxpayer. You are playing oftentimes a vital role in the economy. I think David's point about antisocial hours visas is interesting, but I would actually argue that a lot of the jobs that we need right now in the service industry, in the beauty industry, are jobs that actually natives don't really want to do. I think a lot of these migrants are contributing. So I think the numbers should matter less and sort of the net contributing factor should matter more.
I would take as my judgment, I think, you know, what's happening to those 900,000 NEETs, you know, whether employers are starting to take their responsibilities to people towards the bottom end of the pile in this country by actually training them in ways that they haven't been doing historically. And that, you know, that will help not only the kind of well-being of people towards the bottom end of the pile, but it'll also improve the productivity. You know, we have this famously kind of long tail economy. We got lots of brilliant companies and brilliant high skill workers, and then we got a lot of people at the bottom end, and they have been bypassed in many ways, both sort of economically and culturally, in the last 25 years by people coming in from abroad and kind of leapfrogging over them. And I think, you know, we want those people to get back into the mainstream.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Kate, and thank you for listening. We have an event I'm going to plug now, which you may have heard of before. It's an event we're having next month on the 25th of February at the Emmanuel Centre. Is it time to offer amnesty to Britain's illegal immigrants? Trying to answer that question will be Kate and David, the author of Road to Somewhere, and they will also be joined by other guests, including The Spectator's editor, Fraser Nelson. To get tickets for that event, just go to www.spectator.co.uk/amnestypodcast.